This week on the In the Moment Arts podcast, we ask questions like, what does culture mean? How does faith tie into it? Where is faith headed? And what are the impacts of trauma from generations past on children today? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer. Each week, In the Moment brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or simply ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments podcast. We start out this week's podcast with a conversation with Jeremy Fields. He's the founder of Thrive Unlimited, and he joined Lori Walsh for a discussion about healing trauma in Native American communities. Let's take a listen.
Thanks for being here.
Hello, good morning. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you got into this work and the first time that you heard intergenerational trauma or historic trauma and kind of started to figure out what that looked like in your life and in the lives of others.
Okay. Well, I would say my involvement in this, like working in Native communities, began as soon as I graduated high school. I started out as an artist and a musician visiting Native communities and performing. And the more that I did, the music that I was making had a kind of a socially conscious message to it. And I began to get requests to come in to kind of get youth motivated and inspire them to something better. And in doing so, I came face to face with a lot of the well-known difficulties that we face in a lot of our reservation communities, you know, high suicide rates and different things of that nature. So over the years, I just becoming more and more well-versed in the ins and outs of how that functions within our communities with youth and adults, you know, I began to steer my attention more towards trying to find solutions that would help, you know, culturally relevant solutions, and how is it that we help ourselves lift up out of these difficult places. So that was kind of my beginning in it. As far as this term of historical trauma, I do recall hearing that in my younger days when I was in high school and things, and I didn't feel that it attributed to me. You know, it was something that I felt was kind of seemed like ancient history. You know, that doesn't apply to me. That was my great-great-grandparents or something to that effect, you know. And so it didn't really hit home with me until later in my adult years. And I would say this is probably just within the last 4 to 5 years as myself being a father and witnessing my children become affected by a lot of those difficult situations within our communities, and trying to get to the bottom of what it was that was hindering their mental and emotional well-being, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really what opened the question wide open and really made me take a look at my own life and upbringing and my family. And that's really what kind of opened Pandora's box, so to speak, of everything that had been going on, and really opened a vital conversation for the entirety of, I guess, what we would refer to as Indian country, you know?
So talk a little bit about what we know now that we didn't know about the science of this.
Okay. I think this, you know, the term historical trauma has been passed around, you know, quite a bit over the past probably 10 years, I would say. But I think a clarity of understanding about it has been very absent. What I'm finding as I'm, and my colleagues have been going around the country and facilitating this conversation, is that it seems very new even to our own people, you know. And I had recently had a conversation with a non-Native colleague down in Arizona, I want to say this past summer, and he was trying to get an understanding of where this was coming from, you know, because he too had heard the term used over the course of years and things, and he was saying, what is it that is bringing about the difference in what you're doing? And I was telling him, I think us as Indigenous people within our own communities are coming to a much clearer understanding of it, beyond statistics, beyond this is what happened to you, these are the events within history that caused all of the hardship. But what we're doing is really taking an in-depth look at the organic transitions and transformations that it's brought about within our families, within our personalities, and within our communities as a whole. And one of the analogies that I used was, in my own understanding, I would always relate that term trauma to vehicle accidents, because I would always hear it on the news and you would think of something very abrupt that changes the trajectory of your life or your well-being. And so I used that analogy and I said, you know, if this were you know, the totality of this historical trauma for Native people were to be related to a car accident, here and now today in 2019, when I had this conversation with him, we're still flipping in the air and the vehicle hasn't hit the ground yet. You know, that's kind of the nature of the effect that it's been having within our communities, and how prevalent it still is at work within our families and our homes today. You know, so that being said, it really brings a vital conversation to the table to say, if it really is having this tremendous of an effect, we really need to get a hold of it and understand what it's doing. So what we're, I guess, in that analogy, what we're trying to do is make people aware, open up your eyes and realize we need to brace for impact, because if we don't, something worse is coming, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's already come to the point that it's begun taking our young people's lives because they're not able to answer for the sadness and the heaviness that they carry. But that's what we've been handing them when we're not aware that this trauma is working within our communities and our families. So
this is heavy work for you too. I was watching some of the videos that you have online, and just the stories that people tell you when you have trainings like this about sexual assault, about suicide, about lack of services, not having anyone to talk to. There's a weight of that for you. How do you take that weight and transform it into something positive instead of just, a stone around yourself that's going to sink you to the bottom?
Yeah, it is definitely heavy, you know, and I think that's something that myself and all of my colleagues, you know, we do encounter and we do endure. I think for myself, my own traditional culture would be my answer to it, you know, because that... I think through this understanding of historical trauma and how it's affected our families, it's given me a much deeper and greater understanding of what our culture truthfully represents in its purest form, you know, in terms of spirituality and personal grounding, those types of things. So I've been able to find a very solid center, I would say, in those things. So participating in ceremony and even just taking that time daily to meditate and pray and making sure that I stay centered, you know, and not allowing the vicarious trauma to run away with me, you know, because it is difficult, you know, when you hear these so many stories of your own people, your own relatives, and the hardships that they've endured, you can't help but resonate with it, you know, because it does hit very close to home. And we do form a lot of very close relationships in the process of this, because there is a level of vulnerability that we bring to the table in the way that we share our own personal stories. You know, as I said before, we don't, you know, necessarily reflect upon statistics or, you know, historical dates and things, but this is me and my colleagues standing, you know, in front of the entirety of Indian country saying, here, let me use my life as an example. Let me help you to understand how it is that it intricately affected my family, and how does this resonate with you, you know? But I think that's one of the powerful things about it, is that it creates an objective conversation that isn't necessarily so invasive to individuals' lives, but it's kind of a model that they can bounce their ideas and their experiences off of and kind of have a safe space to begin processing through their own trauma. But I think that being said, though, it's one of those things where it does take, you know, some constant vigilance and awareness in our own space to make sure that we're not overrun again by that vicarious trauma or have that heaviness inundate us to a point that we don't feel like we can continue forward, you know?
Right. So let me use my life as an example. That takes courage.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure you're a humble guy, but I'm going to say it. That just takes a lot of courage for everybody who's doing that work, for people that we've had on this program talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women, for people who have come and spoken about trauma. I'm just sometimes overwhelmed by the courage and the humility with which people share those stories and say, this is about more than me. And how does this resonate with you? That's big stuff.
Thank you.
You mentioned traditional culture as an answer to this, and I want to dive deeper into that, dive a little deeper into why that matters, why that is a pathway forward.
Okay. So I would say that the key reason why it is so important is because that creates our foundation for resiliency. Anything that you encounter in life, there has to be a foundation that you return to that is kind of your solid ground to stand on, and lets you know that you're always capable of bouncing back and recentering yourself and finding your way back to wellness. How it is that culture comes into play is a very important conversation, especially for us to have within our own cultured communities, because Ever since Indian Removal Act, from that time forward, one of the things that's happened is that, you know, we know about the boarding school generation. We know about forced genocide, assimilation, all of these different things that changed the trajectory of how it is that culture played a part in our lives. And we had generations of our people that were taken away from family, sent away, taught that it wasn't okay to be who you were born to be, basically. We had our culture removed, our language removed, all of those things. And ever since that time, our culture has been slowly handed back to us in fragments, you know, religious freedom acts, things like that. You know, those are things that didn't come about for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, depending on which one you're looking at. And all of those things are kind of newly given back to us when we really look at the timeline of it. So moving forward in that fragmented space, it's kind of created blurred lines when it comes to culture. And for a lot of our people, unfortunately, our attachment to culture has become something external. It's been something that we put upon our person in the form of beadwork or traditional regalia when it comes time, you know, when powwow comes around or when ceremony comes around. And oftentimes we find ourselves going through motions. And when we have those questions of why do we do this or why is it this way, oftentimes even our elders aren't able to answer those questions for us. So it kind of becomes a bit of a costume and a shell that we hold to try and find that meaning and the depth in it. But a lot of times those lessons and those values have become very thin, you know. And one of the important parts of the conversation that we facilitate is taking all of those things off of the table, and what does it mean to be Lakota, to be Pawnee, to be Arikara, or whatever the case might be, when all of those things go off of the table, when it's just you there and your person and the doors are closed and there's nobody else, what does that really look like? What does that mean, you know? And one of the ways that we frame that conversation is to be able to say, you know, when we look back in the past and we've all seen those images on posters and history books of these black and white photos of these just staunch, powerful leaders that we had in the past, what is it about those people that really inspires pride within you, you know? Mm. And people will say, well, you know, you could tell that they were fearless, you know, that they were integral people, you know, that it was at all costs they would do what it was that it, you know, needed to be done. And even just that, to be able to say here for all of us in present day spaces, how many of us are really in a space where we're willing and able to make that kind of commitment to our people, you know, within our daily lives, within our personal character, how many of us are really willing to be that upstanding and that integral that there are no excuses, you know? Mm. And that's a difficult conversation to have because there have been so many outside influences that have affected our community. You know, one of the things that we face a lot is these high rates of alcoholism. You know, that was something that didn't exist within our communities in pre-Columbian times. You know, it was something that was introduced and became a coping mechanism as all of this came about and changed our communities, you know? So it's difficult even for us to be able to acknowledge a lot of those hardships that we see even every day in our lives or that we've endured, you know. And, you know, what you had mentioned a little bit earlier about, you know, being brave enough or courageous enough to be able to share those stories, it is really difficult, you know, mm-hmm. for myself and my colleagues that function along with me in facilitating this conversation. None of us have lived perfect lives. You know, all of us have been products of addiction and abuse, and we've been through the thick of it. And that's one of the things that allows us to, I think, facilitate it so well, is because the conversation that we're having is very sincere and very honest. You know, we're not coming from a place of this is what I read in a textbook or this is what the university told me. Yeah. This is, in my case, 39 plus years, excuse me, of personal experience.
If nothing is done, you know, if trauma isn't dealt with, if you try to ignore it or deny it or pretend that we can just get over it, as sometimes we're told, what happens?
That is the worst solution possible, I would say, because I guess for us as Indigenous people, speaking to our Indigenous people, when you look around in our communities and the hardships that exist there, that's the evidence of what happens. All of it is manifestations of us not being allowed or not being capable of healing because of the things that were taken away or not given back. And when you're not able to heal, the only thing that you learn to do is to distract yourself and to cope, to get by to the next day, you know. And even for the underlying concept of our company, Thrive Unlimited, the reason why we chose that name and the concept and the mission of it was to be able to say, you know, all of our lives growing up, we were taught that we came from survivors. You know, that's always the conversation. You came from survivors. Be proud of that. And yes, absolutely, I'm thankful that the people that we came from had the capability of doing that. But at the same time, what allowed them to do that was meant for something different. It was meant to empower them to live fully, to live boldly, to be able to thrive. And ultimately, that's what we want to be able to give back to our people is to be able to do that. But in order to do that, you have to be able to heal. Whatever it is that you go into, whenever you come back in those damaged spaces, tomorrow is going to require you to be at your best again. So it's of utmost importance that you heal. But if you don't, then you only allow yourself the ability to cope and survive. And to really bring that term of survival to the table, you know, it really speaks to that understanding of just getting by until the next day, just getting by another hour, just being able to scrape by with the pain enough that you can feel good for just a little bit longer. But, you know, I know that our ancestors and our people that put forth all of this effort for us to be here today, they didn't, you know, sneak off the reservation at night to hold their ceremonies so that we could just get by. You know, those songs and those prayers were intentions to be able to say, I want these great-grandchildren that I don't even know their name, that I haven't felt their breath yet, I want them to be able to live fully. I want them to know the life that we came from, you know, to be able to have that kind of universal grounding in their cultural understanding. You know, that's what it looks like to thrive, to have no question about your being and your purpose and your worth in living here. And one of the reasons why we see so much of these adversities within our communities is because that's what's been taken away from our understanding. You know, we grow up in environments where there's extreme prejudice and racism. And, you know, we even had, national federal doctrines put into place to be able to say that eliminate them, you know, at all costs, eliminate them. And if you can't physically take their lives, then you take their culture, you take their ability to be well from them. And then you kind of leave an empty shell, you know, so.
What's the potential here with, so many people healing, so many people, you know, recognizing what happened and saying, and now it's time to put that energy into something, that is better than just getting by?
You see tremendous change. And I think, you know, I guess in my own personal experience, I would say going through this healing process, you know, part of the intention was for me to create something better for my children, you know, not wanting them to continue to see them suffer. But then it also opened up for me a realization that I need this healing as well, you know, and that became a part of the mission of I want to be well. I want to know what it's like to live in that space. But as I did, it was something that radiated throughout my family in both directions, from my children and my nieces and nephews underneath me, to my parents, to my grandparents, to aunts and uncles, and even outward into my community. As it began to happen, you know, these conversations begin to start and people begin to open up and say, you know, wow, you know, there really is something here. There are things that have been operating within my family and with even just within my own understanding that I was entirely unaware was affecting my day-to-day life or how it was that I'm raising my children or how it is that I behave in relationships, you know. Mm-hmm. So you see so many positive changes begin to take place. You see family relationships begin to improve, healing within families. You see a lot of these people in the spaces of addiction coming to a space of clarity and being able to shake those things off for good rather than, you know, being clean for a few months and then relapsing back into that situation because they're still trying to numb the pain of what they haven't been able to heal. So answering that question as to why did this happen to us, you know, and why did I deserve this is one of the key things, being able to take people and say, you know, this wasn't something that you deserved or that was intentionally given to you. There was something that collectively happened to the whole of your people that took away these good family values and these good cultural values that taught us how to be good husbands and wives and fathers and mothers and community leaders and these kinds of things. And it was never given back to us. And it hasn't even been our past generation's fault for the places that they've stumbled in trying to understand that, you know, and being able to go back and paint that picture to say, let's go all the way back to the time of this initial wall of trauma where people on the other side were able to live fully. What is it that happened here? And being able to realize, you know, there's something in place that that shouldn't have been there. And for myself, that's what the powerful realization was, is that, you know, I was raised in a home where alcoholism wasn't, you know, extremely prevalent or anything. I didn't grow up in a violent home, anything. You know, I had very wonderful parents and I was provided for, but even so, there were certain things that were absent. You know, we had a difficult time in certain instances being able to communicate emotion with one another, you know, even just to be able to say, I love you, Mom, I love you, Dad, or in the opposite direction. Those were difficult conversations, you know, and that's something that we're still continuing to heal from. And that's okay. You know, it wasn't our fault or something that we chose to do, but that's the environment that we grew up in and we didn't know any different, you know. So we're even in our own space today, we're having to train ourselves to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. But it allowed me to understand that I had never been taught to question my upbringing, but as I began to turn and look backwards, I began to realize throughout these generations, there were so many broken and unhealthy things that weren't present in these people's lives. And I realized, you know, those were things that were handed to me, and it drove me to severe depression when I was younger and drove me to the space of being suicidal, even though I didn't realize that's what was going on at the time, you know. And it even began to attribute to my younger daughter, who was had, you know, she was completely oblivious to all of those things, but it drove her to the point of severe depression and suicidal ideation as well, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what happens when it's not dealt with. But on the opposite side, you know, just the opening of those conversations brings about so many opportunities for healing and so many things that are hindering our community from inside the home to out into society. And you know, it's tremendous. You know, it's been an amazing journey and an amazing process to see the way that it changes people's lives.
Past generations' catastrophes having an effect on their children and future generations is something that goes beyond culture, but is rather something human. Murray Haar is a professor of religion at Augustana University, and he is also the son of Holocaust survivors. He and fellow professor of religion Richard Swanson sat down with Lori for a discussion about how narratives that have lasted multi-millennia offer advice and provide truths still to this day.
Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really appreciate it. Welcome back, Richard Swanson, and
Thank you.
For the first time, Murray Haar.
Thank you. Good
to be here. Feels like an oversight that we haven't had you here, here before.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You're a busy person, so we appreciate you coming down and coming down together, and we ask you together because you have this relationship with each other that also includes conversations about faith. So I feel like I should almost step out of the room and just let you guys talk. But I want to set the stage for what we've been talking about here on the show, which is the future of faith in South Dakota. And we've been looking at statistics of the number of people who no longer identify with any faith, the increase of new faiths like Hinduism to the state of South Dakota that maybe were not here in the numbers that they're here now, and people who have left the church. Predominantly the Christian church is who we've talked to, who have said, it's not for me anymore. I don't like the politics. I don't like the ritual or what have you that they don't like. People who have come back to the church. And so I want to start there with this idea of the numbers say fewer and fewer people, especially young people, are associating themselves with any kind of faith. Are you seeing that in your, when you look around, do you see students, have things sort of changed? You know, you both teach at a traditionally Lutheran college. Murray Haar, start with you, please.
I think in the years I've taught at Augustana, it seems to me more and more students are less involved with Christian tradition and Christian faith. When I first came here, I think most of the students were either Lutheran or Roman Catholic, and a few students maybe who were different or didn't believe. But now I think I would say a good 20% of the students that I have grown up with no religion at all. I mean, it isn't even that they're against religion, it's that their parents just did not bring them up with any religion. And then you have students who are Lutheran and Roman Catholic who don't know much about their tradition. I mean, they're not quite sure why they're Lutheran or why they're Catholic. And so when I teach exploring the Christian faith and we get into just the basics of what it means to be Christian, they're shocked by some of this. They don't understand it. They had certain stereotypes about it. It really is a different set of students these days. And we have a number of people who are atheists as well. And it's fascinating in class because now you have to open the discussion. You can't assume everybody's Christian. And you have to discuss, why should we even bother to study the Bible? Why should we even bother to talk about God? And it raises these questions, which are, I would say years ago, you just didn't have to do it.
I think I see the same thing, but I think that what's changed is the institutional connection of students. They are institutionally disconnected. They are sometimes passionately connected to an institution for sometimes very brittle reasons. But the questions that are underneath the things we study seem just as interesting and just as relevant. But you begin the discussion without the assumption that everyone has learned the terminology. But the questions, I think, are the same. How does this hold together? How do you make sense? What do you hope for? What do you dare hope for?
Why bother?
I'm sorry?
And why bother? Ways you have to answer that question now.
Yes.
In a way that you didn't. Do you? Do you have a responsibility as a professor to say, why bother to answer that question?
I start off like this. I say, why bother to study this stuff?
Yeah.
And if you're an atheist and you don't believe in God, what God don't you believe in? Because you usually have to ask, what do you mean by the word God? Because you've got people who believe in God, but it's really strange when you start to hear what God they believe in. And then you have people who don't believe in God, and when you ask them what they don't believe in, you go, yeah, I'm not sure I would believe in that God either. Maybe no one should. Yeah, so I think this, you have to start off with, I go through all the reasons we ought not to study. And then I say, and yet, what if there's some truth here? What if there's something that this tradition is pointing us to that we need to pay attention to if we care about truth? And then you say, okay, well, maybe there's something there. If you can get them to just say, maybe there's something there, then I think they'll walk with you.
Yeah.
And it is really a different kind of student. The questions, you're right, the questions are the same, but this is a really different kind of student. You have to justify. People say, why should I care about the story with Abraham?
Right.
Who cares? And why is that story important? And it's really, I mean, it's just a different way of approaching it, even though the questions remain the same.
And in some ways, where we start now is where we worked to get 20 years ago.
Yes.
Because if people simply accept it because they always have accepted it and their faith is as real as the wallpaper in their mom's dining room, they haven't thought about that. Now the questions are live and open. And that's what we always worked for back 20 years ago.
So when somebody comes to a scriptural story for the first time, you mentioned Abraham, and I'm thinking of Abraham and Isaac and this, you know, going up and being told to sacrifice his son. Mm-hmm. If you learn some kind of version of that when you're little and it sort of floats in your head as something you always wondered about, that's got to be very different from reading that story when you're 19 and saying, y'all believe what? You know, like, what is this thing telling me? How do you wrestle with some of those really difficult stories that we have a hard time making sense of them today?
I think
in Hebrew scripture,
in the Hebrew scripture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Dick and I, we've taught a class together, a seminar on what's called the Akedah. This is the story of, it's called in Jewish tradition, the binding of Isaac. It's a very puzzling story. Why would God, who just bothered to make a covenant with Abraham that involved land and lots of babies, and who finally he gets a child, and now he tells, take the child and kill the child. And it really raises questions about the justice of God. It raises questions about the way Abraham operates in all this. He doesn't even tell Sarah, and he's taking the kid to kill the kid. And then the question becomes, in this story of Isaac being sacrificed, who's testing who? Because the traditional story wants to say it's God testing Abraham to see if he's willing to kill his child. Now there's parts of Jewish tradition that say, no, what's really happening is Abraham believed God, and he was testing to see who would blink first. And in the end, it was God who blinked, and Abraham nodded and said, of course, I thought so. So it's an interesting, so when you deal with a story like that, you have to allow the questions. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's really a puzzling story. And yet, why did they include it? What's the purpose of this story?
Yeah. And one of the most important things about a story like that is to invite students to have honest reactions to it. If they come in wanting to know what the right answer to their from their tradition is, they will always end up not reading the story, but reading something that's been sanitized. Stories like that are for the purpose of provoking questions. From the beginning, they are for the purpose of provoking questions. Read the rabbis on the Akedah. They have been asking wonderfully rude questions from the beginning. And so if you believe that the only possible faithful response is an extremely polite and well-behaved refusal to ask questions, you have not entered the actual biblical tradition. So it's nice to have someone in the room who's never read the story before.
Because, that's not what I was taught.
Yes.
So many people who grew up in the Christian church, I don't know about your tradition, but in my tradition, you didn't ask questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not insulting any of my Sunday school teachers, but you were the troublemaker if you asked too many questions in Sunday school.
I was raised in a family that believed that's how you're faithful. Yeah. I was lucky.
Yeah, that's nice.
When I went to a school where we were taught that the purpose of these stories was to evoke questions.
Yeah.
When I came to teach at Augustana, what I discovered is, at least at the beginning, many of the students were taught that questions are the opposite of faith.
Yeah.
Whereas I grew up in a tradition where questions were at the heart of faith.
Yeah.
That if you really believed, you would have questions. And the deeper that you trusted, the deeper your questions would be.
And I grew up in a family where if everyone around the table agreed, my father took ridiculous positions so that we would have to ask questions, which is why we've discovered early we get along with each other very well, because we seem to have been raised in the same faith in different traditions.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think you can be threatened by the questions, or you can embrace the questions and say, now we're really getting. The rabbis believe that these stories were written to evoke questions.
Who are we asking the questions of?
The answer to that is yes.
Okay.
Because the questions are that big.
Yeah.
The questions, you're asking the questions of God, because in the story, God asks something that no human being should say yes to. And that means you have to ask questions of God. In the Christian tradition, there is also a tradition of asking questions. Nils Dahl, who was my doctoral advisor, noted that in the Akedah, you suddenly, if the heart of faith is discovering and trusting the promises of God, in the Akedah, God is the obstacle to the promises of God. And that requires you to ask very hard questions about what you mean when you say the word God. But you also have to ask questions of a story like that, of any human system that supports that kind of child sacrifice. So Wilfred Owen's poem, he was a poet in the First World War who wrote good poetry in the trenches, picks up the Akedah, only the Isaac who is laid on the altar and ultimately killed, the young men of Europe who are laid on the altar by their fathers whose pride would not let them bend. Mm-hmm. And the story sets up those questions too. because human systems are very glad to sacrifice young people to old men's pride.
Mm. What's your earliest memory of faith that you now as an adult realize was part of your faith tradition? But maybe at the time you didn't realize that this was part of your faith tradition.
Here's what I think is probably what comes up mostly, and it's early, very early. My father was a scientist. He taught agriculture, but he was a scientist. And the world was full of plants and animals, all of them creations of God. And he was fascinated by the world with its complexity. And so walking with him in a field, or going on a hike with him, or walking out at night looking at stars, every plant would reach out and grab his pant leg and say, "Ooh, ooh, ooh, tell a story about me." And I realized that his sense of wonder at the connections of the natural world was very much faith. And so when he taught me that a scientist knows what she knows and knows what she doesn't know and asks questions about the things that she doesn't know, When my dad taught me that, he was teaching me what faith really was for him. You ask the hardest questions you can so that you can know things as well as they can be known, and when they can't be known, you know that. Hmm. That's probably the root of it for me.
Hmm. I think I grew up in rather a strange apartment in the Bronx where my parents were really they were survivors of the Holocaust, and I think we didn't have any relatives, so there were certain categories you didn't have: grandparents, uncles, cousins. We just didn't have any. Near as we knew, everybody had been killed. So there was rarely any company that came over. But I'm trying to think, you know, for me, a faith was always mixed up with that event in those days. I remember my father, and he says, because you mentioned your dad, I remember my father screaming in the middle of the night. And I went in, and he's saying this Jewish prayer called the Shema, which is very traditional for Jews to say, particularly before they die. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. The Lord is God. The Lord is one." And he's saying this in Hebrew. And I walked into the living room. He's sitting in the chair, and he's sweating. And I asked him. I said, "Dad, what's going on?" And he says, "I'm not going to tell you, because if I tell you, you will have it in your eyes." And he never did. He was a person who believed in God, but who lived with the struggle of believing in God. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think for him it was simple, but I just don't think he ever wanted to pass that on to me. I mean, and yet he did, because to me, I'm just embroiled in these questions because of his experience, because of growing up with no one there. So faith has always been not so much a because, but a despite. Mm-hmm. You know, despite what's happened, I continue to trust. And exactly what do I trust? And what is the nature of my trust? And what questions does my trust bring? I think these are really a part of what it means to be faith. And this is what we're teaching students, is to have, if you're going to have faith, let it be an intelligent faith. You don't need a faith. A simple faith may be not what you're after. But faith should be intelligent. It should trust without knowing for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's what faith is. It's trusting without knowing for sure. If you knew for sure, you wouldn't have to trust. But trusting without knowing for sure. And that's very hard for students, because I think they want either A, some certainty. Or an atheist student who comes to me and says, "Dr. Haar, when you show me that it's really true, then I'll believe." And of course, I don't have that proof. So I try to tell them, you know, faith is trusting without knowing for sure. And there are going to be these things in your life where that's what it's about. And I think this was my dad. I mean, you talk about your dad. That was my dad. I think they believed. I think he, you know, he kept to tradition. But I think he was always aware of the fragility of the tradition.
Do you wish he had told you more?
You know, I think every child of survivors wishes that the father or the mother would have said more. My parents just did not talk about it, and they couldn't see why.
Yeah.
Their notion was, these were terrible things. Why do we want to rehearse them? In the 1990s, when I visited the camps in Europe, my mother was puzzled. Why are you doing this? Why do you want to look at that? It was awful. We never talk about it. yes, your dad, he would scream in the middle of the night, but we never talk about that here. So only later, after they died, did I find some record of what they had been through.
Oh.
I was astounded how they had kept this quiet to themselves and just refusing. And this is not uncommon. Many of the survivors just refused to tell their children what happened.
Yeah.
But I think faith then became mingled with its own fragility. It's just there was a recognition that trusting is not that simple if you have in some way been betrayed.
Yeah.
And I think that's just, and that's true in all relationships, but it's certainly true here. And it really, in the way Dick was talking about his faith, I think in the same way, I think, and when we had these discussions with each other, we would share some of this. You know, we had many lunches where we talked about these and went through this. And he said, and he would listen to that. And I would listen to his way of understanding faith, which is, and we found there were so many commonalities because we both grew up being taught to embrace the questions.
Yeah. And do you need a break where you're just like, let's just talk about the weather for a while? Or do you never, like, I guess what I'm kind of getting at in a broader question, it sounds like a flippant question, but it's not. Because what I'm wondering is there a time when you're in this deep, heavy stuff, either this is what happened to my parents in the Holocaust, this is what anti-Semitism looks like in America today, this is what Christians have done to persecute other people. Is there a point that you need to step aside and say, I need to live in the present and, you know, experience the joy of a blue South Dakota sky or something? That's kind of where I'm getting at with, you know, when is, how do you balance that?
In our conversations, some of the balance happens because arguing with a good arguing partner, that's a good arguing partner is a gift from God. Is such a joy that even the hardest arguments feel like what we were made for and feel like a chance to learn the things that you plain have to learn to be a human being. So part of the answer is arguing through the hard pieces with a good arguing partner is itself deeply joyful. But you notice we go out for lunch to do that, so that we can eat delightful food. Because in the middle of a world full of horrors, there are delights that save your life. And those are as crucial to the exploration as the exploration itself. Because you can't just grind down into the horror, but you can't run from it because we have children that we have to tell the truth to about what faith is and isn't. And we have students that we owe the truth to. And we have students who have seen horrors that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have to understand them as well as we can so that when they raise their hand and say, but what about, we have been there to think about it. Mm-hmm. As a teacher, you owe them that. Otherwise, all we're handing them is fragile stuff that'll break or already has broken in their own lives.
I mentioned anti-Semitism, and people in America have been horrified by the rise in hate crimes against Jews in this country. And we've talked about it on this program inadequately, frankly, because the one time we talked about it, I lost it on live radio and never recovered. So it's a very difficult thing. How do you approach it as a Jewish man living in South Dakota, teaching these students when there is a shooting, when there is, you know, we understand, you know, there's Nazi flyers passed out on a campus or, you know, in a location in the city? Do they come to you for words of wisdom?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a great deal of wisdom, but I think they are puzzled by it, particularly when we study the Holocaust. What motivates hatred? And I think a lot of people think it's a matter of education. I think it is not a matter of educating people, because I think this kind of hatred of Jews is almost a kind of faith. There are people who believe certain things about Jews, and you're not going to convince them that it's wrong, and they're not necessarily open to hearing. So this kind of hatred is very deep. Now, if you ask me, is it ever possible to turn it around? Yes. I think the way you turn hatred around is experience, meaning you meet somebody and you discover son of a gun. He's a person. Look at him. He's got ears. He's got a nose. He's got eyes. He laughs. He makes mistakes. He's a person. And I think, you know, all these years that we started off playing racquetball and we started off having lunch and challenging each other and backing up and then challenging again and backing up and learning that the other person is human. That's quite something. I think that this is not just an other, but it's a person. He's not a perfect person. He's a flawed person, but he's a person. Now, I think you can change hatred, but sometimes people who hate, it's very hard to get out of that box. And I try to teach my students that, you know, don't get in the box, but at least be aware of it. People who hate are sure they're right, and they're sure that what they believe is the truth. Mm-hmm. And once you're certain about that, I'm afraid it's very hard to go against that kind of certainty, because even the attempt to argue about it is already an attempt that doesn't really understand the truth that I have. I have this truth about the Jews. So I just think it's hard in this part of the world because there aren't many Jews running around. I mean, South Dakota has about 300 Jews. I mean, not many people. You meet people, but not many. Yeah. As opposed to the Twin Cities, where there are something like 30,000 Jews. So it's very hard here to gain experience. I remember being I won't say which town, but I was in a small town in South Dakota, and I was doing a talk on Jewish roots of Christian tradition. Fairly not controversial. Yeah. A man came up to me after the talk, and he said, "You know, Dr. Haar, you are a nice person. I really like you. But I'm going to tell you this, I'm still scared of Jews." I was the only Jew he'd ever met. So somehow, here's this guy in a small town in South Dakota, and he's scared of Jews. The Jews are going to hurt him. And even though he met me, and he said, "You're a nice guy," he thought, this is the exception. They are not all like that. So I think it's a very hard subject to talk about. I mean, we tried to talk about it, but I don't think it's a matter of just education.
Yeah.
But there are pieces that are a matter of education as a Christian. Some of that fella in South Dakota, in small town South Dakota, some of that is just societal. Every community generates an other that they are afraid of. And that'll happen. Were there no Jews in the world, there would have been someone that he was afraid of, because we do that. But some of that is rooted in the way Scripture has been read by Christians. And I, therefore, as a Christian teacher, as a pastor, have absolute responsibilities to call that out and make it visible, because some of the ways that Scripture has been read are deadly, and some of the ways that Scripture even has been written are deadly, because there are preserved fights between faithful people who believed Jesus was significant or believed he was not, that got enshrined inside Scripture in ways that are deadly and wrong. And I have a responsibility to call those out. And not just because we're friends, but on account of Murray's down the hall from my office, I got someone who will ask me if I've called him out. Mm-hmm. But it's an absolute responsibility for Christians to look at those and see what's been done with them and to call them what they are.
Can you give me an example?
In the Gospel of John, the Gospel of John is a complex, layered text that for the last century and a half has been recognized to be a composite text that's put together out of several different streams of tradition. One of the streams is very angry, especially at Jews. And in that stream, characters that are carefully identified as Jewish hear Jesus call them to their faces, children of their father, the devil. Mm. Now, it doesn't matter. The complexity of the document of the Gospel of John matters to me as a student of the text. But those words are there whether I argue against them or not. And those words have been deadly. And if I say anything less than that to my students, I have cheated them. Mm. And given given the effect of those words, whoever wrote them, when you get to heaven, ask around, whoever wrote them was wrong. And if Jesus said that, Gospel of John is not a good place to go find quotations from Jesus. The tradition is heavily embellished. But should Jesus have said those, he was wrong.
So we, one of the things we argue about is, what can we do about such texts? So, I mean, I have my students read the Gospel of John, and we talk about them, but, you know, we've argued, should we excise it? Should we just get rid of it?
Tear that page out,
you know, but you can't. It's the Bible. It's part of the Scripture. So I try to teach my students, look at the way this has been interpreted. Look at what people have done with these texts that you're reading here as required, but look what's happened here. I think it's a big shock to my students just to hear that Jesus was Jewish.
Yeah.
He wasn't Christian. There were no Christians. His disciples were Jewish.
Yeah.
His mother was Jewish. There were no Christians. So I think that's a big shock to them. And what's so interesting is if you ask them, I always put this in my freshman exam at the end, I always ask, who killed Jesus? At least half the students, if not more, will put the Jews. That's not what the Gospels say. The Gospels say it was the Romans.
Yeah.
So you ask yourself, okay, where did they get that?
Yeah.
I don't think most of the pastors I know don't stand up and say that from the pulpit. So somehow in the telling of the story, this is what gets communicated, that it was the Jews, and I mean the Jews of all time, of every generation, who killed Jesus. And all of a sudden, we're not just dealing with a story 2,000 years ago in the Gospel of John, but now all Jews are somehow complicit.
Yeah.
All Jews alive in any time. And all of a sudden you realize what's happened here is that somebody has taken this event of the crucifixion of Jesus and somehow labeled all the Jews of all time responsible, which of course is absurd.
Right.
But it's still, you see what's happened to this story and the power of narrative here.
Yeah.
And we argue about this a lot and talk about what should we do? How should we teach this? But we have to teach it. We can't run away from it.
Which brings us back to one of the we were talking about in the beginning, which is there are people who say, well, then I am going to stay away from it. Because if I have to read it that carefully, and I can't do the Sunday school version of it,
mm-hmm.
And then what's the point of diving in this deep? Because I don't have that kind of time in my life, or you know, or whatever your excuse would be. So that brings us back to, I mean, I remember the first time, you know, coming home from Sunday school, and my daughter had learned the story of Noah's Ark, and she was in the back of the car, and it was raining, and she said, "I'm on Noah's Ark, and I'm a cat. And all my friends are dying." And it's like the story, all of a sudden, the reality of what's happening in that story. And I remember as a parent driving, I was like, what am I going to do now? I mean, we have to have a deep, meaningful conversation about this really complicated, difficult story. And I was ready to embrace that as a parent. But it takes time. And so for people who are saying, why should I bother at all with this thing you call Scripture? If it's that complicated, I want it far away. It's done more damage than good.
I think several things, but the thing that probably matters most to me is it matters because life is that complicated. Wrestling with those stories trains you to think about the complications that you had better think about in your business, in your industry, in your own life. If you don't have stories that teach you to ask the hardest questions, like, what do you do when you're saved and all your kiddie friends have died?
Mm-hmm.
That's a question they will have to ask. Every one of our children will have to ask that sometime in her life, because they will sometime be pulled out of the fire when someone else isn't. Those are real questions that are spurred by Scripture. But if Scripture is treated as a prescription for the way everything should be, and therefore fathers should take their sons up the mountain to kill them, oh golly, there was a Sunday school lesson, I don't know if I told you about this one, that I read about just this year. I'm in a clergy discussion group online, and someone was wondering what to do with the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. And someone had seen a Sunday school lesson that they suggested using, which said, One way to experience this story is to go on a fun camping trip with your dad. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Yeah, precisely not that.
No. Uh-uh.
Because in fact, the story is supposed to make you ask hard questions.
Yeah.
Now, the hard questions of that story are not for, that's not the first question you should ever ask in your life. But those hard questions are native to human being. Mm. And if scripture is prescription, I would run from it. If scripture is provocation, then it teaches me to ask the questions I need to ask if I'm going to be a responsible human being.
Mm. I think when Elie Wiesel was here, and he was asked about this problem of questions, he recalled that he had written in the book Night. He said one of his earliest teachers said, "Do not pray to God for answers, but pray to God for the right questions." That you're never going to be able to run away from the questions because life is like that. You know, life is like that. You know, your brother is sick, your mother is sick, your father, somebody. I mean, this is just what life is. I remember my daughter, Jennifer, when she was 10 years old, starting to read newspapers. It was a big thing. She would start, every day she'd look at them. She could read now, and she read the newspaper. And she called me in, and we had sung this song. I always sang to them before they went to sleep. "He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole wide world." And she said, "Dad, I'm reading this, and there were four little girls that were killed in a fire in Detroit. Dad, where was God? You're talking about God as has the whole world in his hands. How can he watch this and not?" And I said, "I think that's a very good question. You should not lose that question." I didn't try to give her some kind of answer, but I tried to say, "Listen, that's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, this is something, it's very important. And I think that's really, that's what I mean by the questions in Jewish tradition again and again. The questions are good. It's not bad. It's actually honest. It's okay."
And if a societal response to her reading the story of the little kids that had been killed, if the societal response is things like that happen, get used to it.
Yeah.
No. Now, that's precisely not the right answer. The song funds protest. That should not happen if God has the world in God's hands. And given that it does happen, I think that makes children inclined to find a way to make it possible to believe for other little children that someone's got them in their hands. It hands us a task.
And my students are always shocked when I tell them, Jesus, in the Gospel of Mark and in the Gospel of Matthew, his last words are, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
Imagine, those are the last words he says. Why does he end like that with the question? Because he feels abandoned. I mean, and I think that's part of what it is to be a person of faith. And so I think part of what we're both doing is trying to teach people to have a mature faith. What does it mean to trust? But to trust without knowing for sure is to live in that tension and to struggle.
Illustration of Noah's Ark as a story about preparation for catastrophe and how to cope is a perfect example of how narratives, arts, and poetry are essential to the human experience. And with that, here's this week's poetry from Studio 47.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Deborah Marquardt. She was born on October 12, 1956, in Napoleon, North Dakota. She grew up on a farm that was originally bought by her great-grandfather. It was a lonely childhood of hard work and few prospects for a creative young girl. After completing high school, she attended university, where she was only two classes away from graduating with a degree in social work. Marquardt realized this wasn't the path she wanted to be on, and she dropped out. She turned to her first love, that of music, and began touring North America with rock and heavy metal bands. It was a life on the road that brought her to a different city almost every night. This lasted for several years, throughout most of the 1980s, in fact, until one night, a fire burned the equipment truck of her band, and over $50,000 worth of guitars and microphones went up in flame. Marquardt decided to turn her attention to writing. After all, it wasn't that much different than creating lyrics. And she re-enrolled in college, where she graduated with an MA in Liberal Studies from Morehead State University. She then went on to get another MA, this time in Creative Writing, from Iowa State University in 1993. Unlike music, which is often enjoyed in a public space with others, reading and writing is more intimate, more solitary. Of this, she recently said in an interview, "What's truly miraculous about writing is the connection between the intimacy the writer experiences when writing and the intimacy the reader experiences when reading. The world feels less lonely when you have that experience." Marquardt hasn't turned her back on performing music, though. Since 1992, she has been a singer-songwriter for the band The Bone People, and although she was keen to leave her rural upbringing in North Dakota, she returns often, and she has written much about the Bakken communities affected by hydraulic fracking. Her books include Everything's a Verb, The Hunger Bone, From Sweetness, Small Buried Things, and The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. She has won a Pushcart Prize, the Mid-American Review Nonfiction Award, a Penn Center USA Creative Nonfiction Award, and an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship, among others. She lives and writes in Ames, Iowa, where she is a professor of English at Iowa State University. In 2019, she was named Poet Laureate of Iowa. Today's poem is Traveling with Guitar. I don't know about you, but I never learned how to play a musical instrument. This means I'm quietly in awe when I see someone filling up a room or a stadium with song. For me, it's like having a superpower. I just don't have the ability to pick up a trumpet or a saxophone or a guitar and then bring out rich notes that can change someone's emotions. And because I don't have this superpower, I don't know what it's like to carry around a musical instrument. I like how this poem gives me a little porthole into that secret world. Here, Marquardt describes what it's like to carry around a guitar when you're not playing it. This is Traveling with Guitar by Deborah Marquardt. For you can travel with a screaming red rolling bag and float unnoticed on conveyors through terminals, or you can lug half a moose rack from Maine to Minnesota, carry it like a broken wing through airports, as my friend Gro did, and draw only the curious touches of children waiting at gates. But dare to travel with a guitar and invite confessions from strangers in pinstripe suits of garage band summers, invite winks, gotcha smiles, and devil horns, rock on gestures. Invite finger points and winks, the long tongue licks, and the rubber neck glance to check if you are someone famous. To dare to travel with a guitar is to mark yourself charismatic megafauna of the airport terminal. Old friend, what else could I do but carry you? I have stored you in closets, propped you in corners, hunched over you late nights, staring perplexed at the mysteries of your neck, body of my body, string of my strings. See how the world began to hum and sing that day at 13 when I opened the big birthday box.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. I know it was a little heavy, but thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwempke, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Iyer. Thank you for listening.